You're listening to episode 2 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Slackware 14 is out. That's exciting. This is the GNU World Order. My name's Clad2. This is a show about Linux and GNU and Unix and other technical topics, but generally those technical topics. And in this episode, yeah, we'll talk about a little bit about Slackware 14, Color Hug, Color Calibration, open source hardware project. We'll also talk about Torchlight and Humble Indie Bundle 6, and probably some other things like some bash tips and listener feedback and so on. So let's get started. Okay, I admit the Slackware 14 thing was just bait. I have nothing to say about Slackware 14 because I'm not running it yet. I've of course installed Slackware Current, which the contents of which obviously become the next release. So technically speaking, I have run Slackware 14, but I don't feel like I've really run it because it was just running it on some test machines to make sure that Slack builds that I maintain still work. So yes, I've seen it. I've used it. No, I'm not using it on a daily basis. But, I mean, what can you say about it anyway? It's a new release of Slackware. It's going to be great. I'm excited. I can't wait to start running GIMP 2.8 on Slackware 14. I can't wait to try out a later version of KDE in my, you know, on my actual production machines. So, yeah, I'm very excited about it, and I'm looking forward to getting the DVDs in the mail. The DVD set, or the DVD case, the DVD media has two sides to it, a 32-bit side and a 64-bit side, so I will actually be installing 64-bit mostly, but I might find a spare machine lying around that can give me a reason to go back to 32-bit just for fun. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and if you have not tried Slackware yet and want to try a Linux distribution that is stable. And I know that's a cliche to say, oh, Slackware, it's rock solid, it's stable. But at the same time, like, if you really think about what that means, I think it's like slipping into a comfortable shoe. And that's beyond even saying, oh, I know Slackware, so it's a comfortable shoe. It's actually saying, oh, I remember what it was like to sit down in front of a computer and not have its operating system change every 3 or 6 months. And I think as Linux users, a lot of us get into the habit of really enjoying changing our operating system every 6 months. It's a fun thing to do. You get to try new things, see how different distributions put stuff together. I totally get that addiction and that passion, and I think it's good, and I think that in so doing that you find new and interesting bugs, or not even bugs, but just problems. You know, you find new things that could possibly go wrong on a computer, and you learn how to fix them, and things like that. So it's a good experience. But I will say that if you're truly looking to settle down and take a break from the I'm installing Linux all the time and I know all the potential problems that are possible when installing Linux because I do it every other week, and you want to get real work done, then you might want to take a look at something like Slackware, or actually Slackware, because it really is. You install it on your computer. You set it up, you install the programs that you know that you're going to need and that you're going to use, and then you just use the thing. And it becomes a normal computer like you used to have when you were a kid and your dad used to maintain your computer for you, so it always worked and it was just kind of there, and that's what happened. Don't forget just because you're using Linux that such things exist, you know? I honestly, in a way, I honestly think it's almost difficult to with a rational mind recommend a computer, a Linux computer to someone when you think of Linux, you think of, well, you have to change the operating system every 2 weeks, you know, because that's not the case, and people who see you doing that or think that that's how it's done, that can be a little bit misleading because a lot of normal users don't want to do that. So don't forget that Slackware exists. I don't worry, I won't let you forget. But just in case, you know, don't forget that Slackware exists. It's going strong. Slackware 14, looking great. Try it today. Humorous related story to this, by the way. This past week, I was kind of roped into helping some people upgrade their Windows installs. Now, I have said in the past, publicly, and I will say it right now, again, that I have no personal beef against Microsoft or Windows. I really have no experience with them whatsoever. I guess I could say that if I had a personal grudge against them, it would simply be that they've always excluded me from their little micro-eco-sphere. So, or it's not very micro, is it? But, you know, their little world has always excluded me, and not necessarily by my choice, although I was raised to dislike Microsoft. But in terms of times that I could cite having been wronged by Microsoft, there's really not been a time that it's ever personally affected me in the way that a lot of people have, like, horror stories, you know? Oh, I've got my fair share of those about a different computer vendor, but not about Microsoft. So, and that's kind of one reason I really don't tend to speak poorly about them, because I have no war stories. I don't have that experience. The longest I've ever been in front of a Windows computer is probably checking email on a cafe, in a public computer at like a cafe or a library or something. And even that, I can't really actually cite a time that that's happened. I'm just kind of, I have vague memories of that being an experience. So there's that. So asking me to help people, or to help you upgrade your Windows box is a very bad idea, because I've zero experience with, certainly with any kind of system maintenance on Windows, and a near zero experience with actually, you know, the interface. So here I am trying to help these people. Obviously the first thing I'm going to do is do an internet search on how to upgrade Windows from XP to 7. And I get this semi-official, I mean, it looks like an official Microsoft site. It might not have been. It was called Windows Team Blog or something. So it might not have been, I didn't do a whois or anything, I didn't really care, but it might not have been official Microsoft. But it was definitely a well-organized site and a nice-looking kind of professional-looking site with all your Microsoft tips and stuff like that. So I'm reading this one blog post that they did on how to upgrade Windows, and I'm not kidding here, but there's a paragraph in there, and I'm just going to quote it straight off the site. This is a good one. "I don't think it is possible to explain the entire set of desktop migration tasks when moving from one operating system version to another within one page." That's a quote from this WindowsTeamBlog.com site. That is how the guy prefaces the fact that he's going to have to write a series of articles on the process of migrating your user data and stuff like that when you're upgrading your Windows version. Okay, he's responding to requests for a one-page kind of quick cheat sheet on how to migrate Windows from one version to another, and that's his response. And I saw that, and I just thought, I don't think I could fill a page on your migration tasks when you are moving from one Linux version to another. I might be able to generate maybe a sentence, or if I'm very, very verbose, I guess I could do two sentences, but not being able to describe the process in a one-page kind of quick cheat sheet blog, I was astonished. It was very funny to me, because, again, I didn't even come to this with any kind of bias or chip on my shoulder or expectation of, oh, this is going to be rich. You know, I didn't care. I was just trying to help these people with their little upgrade, and there was nothing in it for me, and there, I've never been burned by Microsoft. It was really one of those moments where it just became very clear to me why someone might not like Microsoft Windows when you read a paragraph like that. So that was funny and important to take note of, because speaking of upgrading Linux distributions and upgrading your operating system, apparently if you're doing that on Windows, you've got a nice 3-volume set of blog posts to read before you can start that process. So enjoy that. And now let's get into listener feedback. Oh wow, that is a really that sounds like listener feedback music, doesn't it? I should try to remember to make that a standard. Anyway, I played that as a by way of apologizing for skipping listener feed, you know, letting Slackware get in there before listener feedback, because obviously for the past half of a season or so, I've been doing listener feedback straight from the top. So I don't want you to think that I no longer take listener feedback seriously. It's just I thought Slackware 14 was kind of an excuse to mix it up a little bit. So listener feedback, I actually had quite a bit. So don't really know where to start, but we'll just start from the top of my notes. How about that? So Thrice in IRC, I'd actually bugged him last week, or, you know, before last episode, to submit his bash sh or bash rc rather file, because I just kind of felt, I had this feeling that he probably had a good bash rc file, which I'm not really sure why I would have thought that, because I know and I have known for a while that he's a zsh kind of guy. So I guess I was really bugging him for his .zsh rc. Point being, he sent me a beautiful little function. Actually, it was an alias. Alias, quote, ls, close quote, equals, quote, ls space dash dash color equals auto, close quote. Some advanced ZSHRC stuff. Kind of makes you want to switch to ZSH right there, doesn't it? All kidding aside, he did refer me to a link, which sort of goes, like, if that's one extreme, this kind of goes to another extreme. It is, I want to say, a book-length ZSH file. It's kind of ridiculous, but at the same time, you know, you have to kind of sit back and look at it and wonder, is it ridiculous, or is it cool? So if you go to git.grml.org, and then a bunch of other stuff that I'll just have to put into a link in the show notes. It's some random guy's ZSHRC file, and it's not a trivial file. It is a long file. It has got a lot of stuff going on in it. It's definitely worth a look anyway. Even if you, I mean, I can't imagine just copying and pasting this into a file and calling it ZSH and just running it. I mean, it's big. You'd almost, I imagine, have to read it through just to kind of see what it's making available to you. But it's really cool. It's a good read. Definitely something to keep you kind of involved in something very geeky. So if you got nothing better to do and you're just looking to read some code that you're not a programmer, you still might be able to understand, then check this out. ZSHRC file from git.grml.org ?p equals grml dash etsy dash core dot git semicolon. Well, trust me, it's a URL. I'll put it in the show notes. So that was Thrice's contribution. Thank you very much, Thrice. Ken Fallon from Hacker Public Radio, I'm sure you've probably heard him and possibly know him from IRC or email or Hacker Public Radio mailing list. Anyway, Ken Fallon sent me an interesting, I'll call it an alternative to Remy's tree listing function in his bash RC file. So if you remember last week, or look at the show notes even, from last week, Remy had this function that used ls and stuff like that, but also used sed to really almost draw, as it were, a file tree, directory tree of the directory that you're listing. And it looked really cool, and I was raving about it. I was really excited about it. I was like, this is completely game-changing. This changes Bash into a completely other application. And I stand by that, because I really think that little things like that really make it feel different. And it puts a lot of power into the user, because you can really change the way that you use this application through very simple things like little functions that draw out directory trees for you. It was cool. Well, Ken sent me a version of that that is a one-liner, if you could even call it a one-line. It's really like three words. It's find-type-d. That, of course, is saying find-type directory, and so then it produces a listing of all the directories with all the files that are in those directories. So it's a similar thing. Whether or not it's the same thing would be debatable. And that's what I kind of said to Ken, that yes, the much shorter version that he provides is very cool, because it is fast, it's built in, etc. But if you look at the two outputs, it's just not the same thing. There's just no, it's different. It looks different. And it's kind of the question of what you have as the user want. You know, I mean, do you want the nice, cool ASCII art of, hey, here's my directory tree, and here are lines, pipes, and dashes to kind of guide you to what is an attribute or a member of what other upper level thing. So, I mean, that to me looks and feels different enough to make it significantly independent of something like, hey, why don't you just type in find-type-d? One of the things that I used to do was simply an ls-R, which was list directories recursively, and that kind of did the same thing. But again, it just didn't look the same, and it didn't feel different. So I'm arguing that Remy's solution is a valid solution, and Ken's solution is a valid solution, and it's up to the user to decide which one they prefer. Which, again, I mean, it's a great reason to rave about Bash and the ability to have a bunch of customizations. And what about those customizations? I might have said this on a previous episode, but for some reason it came up again in conversation. And someone was saying, oh, I don't do a whole lot of customizations because I'm always afraid that if I rely on my customizations, then I'll be in front of a computer and not have those customizations, and it'll completely throw me off. And again, it's one of those things where both of those arguments, I think, that argument, because I haven't told you my argument yet, that argument is totally fair and valid, because I've been in that situation. I've sat down at a computer and started using it, and just kind of like, why on earth, how do people use it like this? And I actually have done that on a couple of different programs, Audacity not being by any means the least of those. I use Audacity quite frequently, both for podcasting and on the job, and when I sit down in front of someone else's computer and they've just downloaded Audacity and they fire it up and it's the stock configuration, I almost cannot use it, because it's just, in my opinion, the interface is so bad. And I have customized the interface to the degree that it's just so much more efficient, I think, for me, but I just think it's a better configuration in general. And so I've taken to carrying an audacity.cfg on my thumb drive, and I have it on my little internal cloud, if you will, and I can download it quickly and install that configuration file and launch Audacity and be in my own configuration. And the same honestly goes for my Emacs, my .emacs file, and my elisp directory, and my bashrc file. In other words, in my real life, I have found that on a practical level, I'm always in a place where I can get my configuration files very easily. They are readily available to me. I can install them in no time at all, and I'll be up and running as I'm used to doing in no time at all. So that's kind of it's a non-issue for me. It doesn't matter. It's not something that I'm afraid of. I don't have to be worried about sitting in front of a computer and not being familiar with the tools because I've got my configuration files. In other cases, I imagine that might not work out. You might not be able to have that, and I don't think it's such a big deal. I guess I'm also, in my mind, I am also cognizant enough of my changes. I know what I've customized, and so the moment I try something and it doesn't work the way I want it to work, it's not like I have to spend an hour trying to figure out what's wrong, and then I realize, oh, it was just my configuration file. I haven't lost sight of the stock configuration, at least yet, and it doesn't really seem to matter to me that I've customized the heck out of some of the programs that I use on an everyday basis. So there's that. And I guess my point is that you have to take, I mean, I don't know, I tend to form these very paranoid kind of, oh my gosh, worst case scenario, I'm on a computer and I don't have my configuration file, what would I do? Or, oh my gosh, the feds break in and they grab my hard drive, what would I do? Or, you know, whatever. Like, you kind of start to form these weird sort of, yeah, but I don't want to do this because it could really go badly. And after like a year or two or three of working and never coming up against that issue, I think at some point you have to kind of forsake some of those paranoid delusions and just kind of accept that your life is a simple one and that you are only around computers and you that have a command line, and you are only around computers and you have your configuration files in your pocket on a thumb drive and you can load it onto those things. And the person whose computer it is, if you're helping them out, has never used Bash anyway, and they won't care that you are now installing a new Bash RC file on their computer because they don't care. They're never going to use it themselves anyway, or they're not familiar enough with Audacity to care, or you could back up their configuration file and then install yours. You know, I mean, it's just not an issue. So I'm a big fan of configuring things to work the way that you want it to work, especially given that I, and I know a lot of other people, are the same way. We came to Linux because of the customization. So don't be afraid of it. You know, leverage it. That's something that we can do. That's why we're using this OS. We can change it to our very whim. And speaking of not wanting to customize things, actually, I think this is actually when it came up, now that I'm thinking about it. VulcanWriter emailed me, and I think we were talking in IRC, and he was saying, I think, that he didn't customize things. And the reason that he had is actually a really good one, and that is that he's constantly SSHing into other servers because he's a sysadmin. So he's doing a lot of work in different terminals, and he would do some kind of simple shortcut, you know, like LL for a list in a list view. And, of course, on another server, on another session, it wouldn't be that wouldn't be in the Bash RC file, and he couldn't customize it because other sysadmins might be using, or, you know, might use that login or whatever. So there's the other side of that argument. But he did send me some kind of interesting aliases on his that he has on his workstation, which he uses to sync podcasts with his N900, his Nokia N900, which is pretty cool. But he does an alias to Syncasts, like, or Syncasts, I guess, SYNCASTS. TS equals, quote, /SCP/data/gpodder/downloads/asterisk/asterisk.ogg/data/gpodder/downloads/asterisk/asterisk.mp3 space some place that is the host colon my docs/dot sounds/podcasts close quote. So I would imagine that he's using his SSH keys so that that's a passwordless login, and he just issues that command, and everything goes over to his N900, and then he can listen to podcasts all day. So that's pretty neat and really quite smart. And I dare say just one of those examples of how Linux can just be so darned efficient. You've got SSH keys set up. You've got two devices. All you have to do is type in the word, because you've customized it. You type in the word syncasts, and suddenly your device is loaded up with all these different podcasts. As opposed to sitting down at your computer, you plugging in your device, you starting up your music player or podcatching aggregator, and then you dragging and dropping the things over or whatever the workflow is once you go into one of those GUIs. It just, I don't know, it seems pretty cool to me. Another little modification he's got is a couple of tricks for his bash prompt, which is kind of cool. I didn't really know a whole lot about this one. So if square bracket space dash F space slash etsy slash bash prompt close square bracket semicolon then dot space slash etsy slash bash prompt end the if statement with a backwards if. What that's doing is it's saying if there is a file that exists at slash etsy slash bash prompt, then I don't really know what that means, the dot. I mean, I do know what it means. I don't know how to say it in words. It's dot space slash etsy slash bash prompt. It's kind of like a source or exec. I'm not sure which one that is technically. But anyway, that, it sort of loads, it uses slash etsy slash bash prompt. He's saying that slash etsy slash bash prompt changes the color of the prompt. And he uses Red Hat style prompts because when he started using these, this little script of his, that's what he was using. So it's kind of set up that way. But for the local box, a user's prompt is user at host and then space the directory and then, you know, a dollar sign. And now that gets set to the color cyan. So if he's a local user on the local box, then it is cyan, I think, right? Yeah. And then if he's root on that local box, then it turns, the prompt gets colored red, and it says, like, host name, and then the full path, and then a hash mark. Now he does a user prompt on the remote box that he does even more color coding for, like the directory and the dollar sign gets colored green for SSH sessions. And he even goes so far, at least on his home boxes, I think he said, to give, like, he can tell what release he's on. So, because he runs a lot of Debian, so it's cyan hostname for him equals Debian SID, gray equals Debian testing, yellow is Debian stable. So he can tell at a glance what release he's on and what user he's logged in as. So that, I thought that was really cool. Very, very interesting. On to the next one. Doug Farrell, big proponent of Python. I've mentioned him before. I've even pasted some of his Python code into a show note somewhere. He emailed me an interesting link about Python for Bash scripters. This is an article that was posted to the Red Hat magazine back when it was Red Hat magazine. Now it, of course, is opensource.com, a really cool site as well, but at one point it was magazine.redhat.com, and this article was posted about 2008 or so, and it's really an interesting article. I don't know if it does a great job of selling you on the idea that, hey, if you're doing bash scripting, you could do all that stuff with Python, or you should be doing it with Python, because I don't know that that's, if that comes across. If you go to it, however, thinking, oh, I want to do more Python, what would be a good excuse to do that? Oh, I know, I'll do what I would normally do in Bash with Python. That would be good. Then this article makes a lot of sense. I came to it almost, for some reason, wanting to be sold, and I wasn't sold on it. I was like, well, I don't get it. What makes Python better or even as good as Bash? But I think that's the wrong angle. And then after I thought about it a little bit, I was like, wait a minute, I don't know if you're sold on this. I want an excuse to practice Python. And he's telling me how to do that. Because there have been plenty of times in fairly recently that I've thought, you know, I'm writing this script and I really should be, I need more practice, I feel, in Python. I should be writing it in Python. But, like, the thought of it, the very thought, is just like, oh no, then I have to look up which module to import for system level, you know, OS kind of operations, and you just kind of, like, you freeze up and you're like, I'll just do bash really quick, and it's over, you know, bang, you bash it out, and and you're done. But I mean, if you want to practice Python and you're doing a lot of shell scripting anyway, then this is a really good idea, and this article is a great resource for that. Raven, who's been emailing me, you know, off and on for a while, ever since probably last season or so, but he says he's loving Sabayon 10. He's really, really excited about Sabayon 10. I tried it. I was like, I'm looking for an excuse personally to try out Sabayon a little bit, you know, like to start using it a little bit here and there. Just, I'm curious, I'll admit it. The Gentoo way intrigues me. I'm not ashamed to admit that. I think it's got, from my experience so far, it's got a little bit of the port feel to it, you know, the BSD ports, which I like. I like it in Slackware, I like it in BSD, I wouldn't mind liking it in Gentoo. And yet it seems like easier than Gentoo, you know, you don't have to do the whole building it from total scratch, which, while I respect building it from total scratch, I think if I was going to build something from total scratch, I would literally build it from scratch, i.e. Linux from scratch. I don't know that I need to do it Gentoo from scratch. So anyway, Sabayon appeals to me. I was looking for an excuse. He emails me, says, oh my gosh, Sabayon 10, it's great. So I download the thing, and I try to install it on a spare computer. And this computer, particular brand of computers, uses a very, very poorly implemented version of EFI, and it just won't boot. I tried putting the bootloader onto the MBR. I tried on the first part of the first partition. It just wouldn't boot. Now, I know that I could get around that. I could, you know, as long as the bootloader is maybe on the first partition, I could get myself up and running on something else and then boot off of that first partition. But I wasn't that interested in going that far. So I'm glad Raven likes it, though. Raven's girlfriend sort of wrote in by way of Raven and recommended two different applications if you are a Fedora user. One is called Easy Life, and the other is called Fedora Utils. And Fedora Utils I've used, actually. I thought it was a pretty clever little application, and it also is kind of intriguing because it is, if I'm not mistaken, actually just a shell script, but it uses that Zenity GUI builder for Bash. So, you know, even though it's just a shell script, it's got a nice-looking little GUI. You can put little tick marks in the little boxes that you want it to do for you, and then it does it. Easy Life I've not used yet. I will give it a go once I have another computer running Fedora. The one that was running Fedora right now had to get used somewhere else, and it's not really something that I'm at all that often now. But I gather that both of them do essentially the same thing, which is make it really a breeze to get certain user, you know, normal user things into Fedora really quickly. I know that that's what Fedora Utils was completely geared towards. It was, you fired it up and you could install multimedia codecs, DVD codecs, libcss. Well, I guess that's the DVD codec thing that I was really referring to. But, I mean, even just random extras, well, GNOME tweaks, that was one of them, but also, like, really random stuff, well, Flash, that's another one, but anyway, also really random ones, like Google Chrome, or something like that, because Chrome isn't in the Fedora repository. So basically, anything that took any amount of extra thought or effort on a user's part to kind of get Fedora set up, this application took care of it. So check out Fedora Utils and Easy Life, and see if they make your life easier. Last listener feedback for this episode is from Grizzly. Now, that's a great name, Grizzly is. And with a name like Grizzly, I really had hoped for some kind of juicy story about something very rustic and coffee-related. You know, Grizzly? Come on, you can't go around with the name Grizzly and not tell me about how you roasted coffee yourself on your outdoor wood-burning stove and then went over to a tree and extracted maple syrup fresh from the tree. I guess that's how it works. If you're out in the woods, I imagine, you could have some coffee with some maple syrup in it, and that would be good. So anyway, he didn't tell me any of that stuff, but that's what I've imagined for him. So Grizzly, as he lives out in the woods, drinking custom roasted coffee and maple syrup, sent me a little bit of feedback, said that yes, the assumption that those conditionals, the while statement and the if statement or whatever, were conditionals. I was right about that because I remember I was a little bit unclear as to whether my terminology was correct. And then he sent me this cool little function that he has in Bash, in his Bash RC file. It's called change link. This is something I never do, but I can definitely see how it would be really, really slick and nice to have if you actually do it. And frankly, it's got some really cool tricks in it. So here's what he does, and we'll go over this kind of line by line, more or less. So shebang slash bin bash. If, so actually it might not be a function, it's just a shell script that he uses. Anyway, if square bracket dollar sign hash space exclamation equals space 2 space close bracket, then echo the usage. And the way he does the usage is really cool, because he does dollar sign 0 link name path, meaning that whatever you type in, whether you did a dot slash change link or a change link or a tilde slash bin slash change link, then it echoes that for you so that it's returning exactly what you typed for the command, which I thought just was kind of neat for user friendliness. And then it tells you sort of like where link name is the name of the symbolic link, and path is the name of the new path that you want the link to, the symlink to point to. So that's just like the error message if someone didn't know how to use the command. So then he does an elif bracket dash capital L space quote dollar sign one quote close bracket. And of course, this is new to me. The dash L means for a test, for when you're testing something, it means if the file exists and is a symlink, which was pretty cool. I'd not used that one before. That is pretty neat. If you ever need to test a condition in a shell script, just do man test. You'll be amazed at some of the things that they have there. You know, the dash D for if it's a directory and it exists. Dash Z, I think, does something cool. I don't know. I've used a couple, but dash capital L was new to me. I thought that was pretty neat. And then it says then temp equals, and this is again really cool. So he's establishing a variable temp equals dollar sign or quote. Notice how he's escaping all of his things too. That's kind of nice, or you know, quoting everything so that spaces and weird symbols don't get all messed up. Double quotes, dollar sign, open parentheses. Make temp, MKTEMP. I'd never used it before. I looked it up. I like it. It literally creates a temporary file and ensures that it is uniquely named. How often have you needed that and not known about that command? A lot for me. So make temp space quote change link XXXXXXX close quote close paren close quote. So what that does is, like, if you run this command, you'll see that it's making a temporary file named change link XXXIW capital D CWP. In this case, of course, it's going to be unique each time. But those trailing X's tell it how many characters it can use to ensure the uniqueness of the file name, which I thought was pretty cool. Next line, rm, quote, dollar sign temp close quote. If ln space dash sv space quote dollar sign 2 quote space quote dollar sign temp quote, then remove the dollar sign 1 argument and move the temp the temporary file to dollar sign 1. The thing that does is it goes it you've we've created a temporary file called change link XXXIWDCWP in this case, and it assigns it to your new path, and then it removes the old link, the old sym link, and then it renames the temporary file back to what it used to be. So I just did a quick test. For example, I made a directory, called it test. I touched one file, called it one, or did I, a file or a folder? I don't remember. But I created, it was a directory, one, and then I made a directory called two. And then I did change link, and then, oh, I made another directory called three. So I did a change link two to three. So, well, actually, that errored out, so because I forgot to make 2 a symlink. So I got rid of 2, I made a symlink and called it 2, and symlinked that to 1. So ln dash space dash s 1 space 2. So now 2 is just a link to the 1 directory. And then I did change link 2 space 3, and that made a temporary directory and assigned it to 3, and linked it to 3, rather, and then it removed 2, and then it changed that link's name to the word 2, because that's what it used to be. And it's that simple. He has an else in there to echo $1 is not a link in the event that you give it an argument like I did at first, which was trying to change like a non-linked file to be a link to something else. But otherwise, it worked really, really well. It was a cool little script, and of course I'll paste that in the show notes so you can look at it and kind of learn from it yourself. I was really impressed with make temp and that test condition of the dash capital L. So I want to urge you to look at the man page for the test. Okay, let's move on to my review of the color hug. But first, all that talk about that coffee out in the woods with Grizzly made me thirsty, so let's go get a cup of coffee. Whether you're out in the woods hanging out with Grizzly or not, go get yourself a cup of coffee. Make it good, make it rustic, make it strong, and come right back and we will finish up the show. At the top of the show, I said I was going to talk about a couple of different things, and I've had to reconsider that because I'm running out of time. But I think one of the topics I was going to talk about, which is Torchlight and the Humble Indie Bundle, will actually fit better with the next episode, 803. So I'll save it for that. But Color Hug is something that I did want to talk about, and incidentally, it's something that I found out about more or less via listener feedback, I guess you could say. Mr. Work, a friend, or Mr. Jackson, a friend in, or is it Mr. Tablet? Well, this guy in IRC that I know, I've mentioned him before, told me about this cool color calibration tool, open source hardware, that was out for Linux. And I got really excited about it. And I thought I'd ordered it. And I guess, because this was like months ago now. And either I had, and it didn't go through, or maybe they weren't ready for ordering yet. I'm not really sure, but anyway, a couple of weeks ago, I for whatever reason, I remembered it, and I decided, hey, I need to go get me one of those. I want to try this thing. So I ordered one, and I very recently, just this week, got it in the mail. So I have tried it, and I would like to talk a little bit about it. Now, if you are not in multimedia, and if you are not a frequent, like a graphic designer, I guess, who's doing a lot of high quality printing and stuff like that, you might not ever really have the occasion to even bother with this. But for some people, and I'm not necessarily including myself in this group, but since I'm around people to whom this is important, it's kind of by default a little bit important to me. And on some level it is important to me, and so let me tell you why. So color calibration is for digital representation. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's for representations of color. And this could be in a couple of different places. The most common and popular one of these is on your computer screen. Now, I was kind of taught as a video maker that the representation on your monitor of color is almost not really that important, because the color that you see on your monitor is never going to be the same color that everyone else sees on their monitor anyway. So if you are fooling yourself by calibrating your own monitor, then you're kind of, there's a false sense of security there. You're like, well, I've calibrated my monitor, so everyone's going to see it exactly like this. And then you project it, or you take it to your friend's computer and show it to them, or you pop it on your TV, and it's completely different anyway. So the goal was never to achieve some kind of all-holy sort of archetypal, you know, shade of some color, because color is perceptive, right? There's no absolute shade of any color. We couldn't sit down together and look at a bunch of color swatches and say, okay, this red right here, that's the true red, and all other shades of red or representations of this particular red are false. There is nothing like that. You know, there are people out there who don't even see red, or don't see green, or don't see whatever. So it's not, there are no colors. There are just how we perceive these things, that they look like a shade of color to us. And that was kind of what I was taught as a digital artist, is to make sure that everything is correct in ratio and in scale and in context to one another. And to a very large degree, I still subscribe to that. Because if you distribute your work on other media, whether it's on another screen or another sheet of paper or another, you know, if you print it to, I don't know, well, glossy versus matte, you print it onto a CD disc or something, wherever this thing is headed, the colors have the potential of being different. And there's, at some point, there's not a whole lot you can do about that. That's one side of the coin, and inevitably there's another, and it's just as good. So in some cases, it is important to calibrate your monitor, and I'll tell you a couple of the times. One is when you have a two-screen setup, and very recently I was working on a photo shoot, and we had two screens, and I was using Darktable on Fedora. Great program, by the way, if you have not tried it, and you have a DSLR workflow, you absolutely, or even just a RAW workflow, you absolutely, or even a digital camera workflow, you absolutely owe it to yourself to check out Darktable. That's not the topic of this conversation, however, so I'm going to move on quickly. But definitely check out Darktable. Please. It's amazing. And anyway, Darktable was being used on two different monitors, and literally taking the photograph, looking at the photograph in Darktable, and then exporting it out of Darktable, you know, with the choices that we've made there, opening it up in GIMP on another screen, you could look at the two screens and you're just like, oh, wow, those are two completely different photographs. That was an obvious time when calibrating your monitor would make sense, because, I mean, while what I just said was true about, yes, you should just make sure that the colors are correct to this scale, it's insane to try to do that in two different color spaces. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. It's like you're working against yourself. So that's important. Another time is actually any time that you are doing digital photography, to be honest, because, I mean, you kind of do owe it to yourself to calibrate your monitor. Because what calibration does for your monitor is it actually just tells the video card where, you know, it imposes constraints on your digital, on your video card, because your GPU was manufactured and put into the computer, and it's not like the same people who made the GPU are also making the monitor, and they're making them together, and they're adjusting one for the other. A monitor is a thing that lights up, and a GPU is a thing that sends a bunch of pixels to that monitor. Sometimes the brightest possible value that a GPU can send is way too bright for a monitor, for a specific monitor, and it does. It changes on a per monitor basis. So I have taken a digital photograph that was perfectly fine, very well exposed and everything, not overexposed, and you look at it on the LCD screen on the camera, you look at it on the LCD screen of one monitor, looks great, then you take it to your workroom and load it up onto your workstation, and suddenly all the bright parts of the picture to you look completely overexposed. That's one of the cases where you could really use color calibration if you're really worried about that sort of thing, because a color profile, it will constrain the GPU and say, hey, you can't send white pixels of this value to this monitor, because it will blow out. That's the maximum white, and you're sending way more than the maximum white. So these shades of gray that should look almost white, but not quite white, are looking white. And to a user, that looks like they're blown out, and it's like it's lost information. And you can do that manually on some monitors. You can dial down the gamma and stuff like that. But a color profile will kind of run through color swatches of all conceivable shades. I mean, it takes a few minutes, and it just shows all these color swatches to this little camera-like device, and it figures out, okay, yeah, that's what I expected to see. Oh, that's too bright. I'd better write down for the monitor in a color profile thing that the maximum value for this shade should be dialed down to here so that I get the correct values. So it's basically just using a set of known color values and seeing what happens when the monitor that it's looking at that moment, what happens when it shows, when it broadcasts that color. Is it too bright? Is it too dark? How do we get it adjusted so that it matches what a sane value for that shade would be. Kind of makes sense, I think, I hope. Now, the Color Hug is an open source hardware project that some guy decided to do because he knew a little bit about electronics, and he knew a little bit about Linux, and he knew a little bit about color, and I have to say, it's brilliant. It is absolutely phenomenal. I don't even know how to begin to restrain my excitement over this device. It really, truly is it's just an exciting device. I have used really, really nice color calibration devices in my time, and this one, I don't even see a difference between this and all the others, except that this one is open source hardware using an open source software interface, and it's cheaper than any of the other ones that I've seen, even when shipping from England to where I am in America. So this was a big deal to me. I wasn't expecting it to be a big deal. I was very, very prepared for this to be a hobbyist's product that would do a little bit of color calibration, nothing too fancy. I was ready for it to be very simple and kind of a cool hacker kind of project, and I would have been okay with that. But what I got was something that is production ready. I mean, it should be, if anyone asks me for a color calibration recommendation, I will definitely be recommending this. The price alone, honestly, is really good. The price competes very nicely. Why? Well, one, because I guess the name brand doesn't exist for the Color Hug. I mean, it's the Color Hug. No one's heard of it. So it can be a little bit cheaper, I guess. But another thing that the really ultra-expensive ones do that the Color Hug does not is that it can calibrate, that the more expensive ones can calibrate printer output, meaning you literally place the color calibration onto a printout of a bunch of color swatches and manually get settings of, you know, per cartridge of what your printer is actually putting out on that paper stock, and then you can load those color profiles onto the computer that is interfacing with that printer and tell it to use that color profile whenever sending data to that printer, and then it constrains the way that the printer interprets color. In my experience, I have found that that is not really necessary. As long as you've calibrated your monitor and you're sending it to a printer, I have found that the computer and printer tend to talk to each other well enough that I've been totally happy with the printouts that I get, like really happy. And in fact, here at the place that I work, where we have artists artists and students using very high quality, big room sized printers, they don't take up the whole room, square footage, but I mean, they, you know, an entire wall in one big, large format printer, and no one bothers color correcting the printer. It's not necessary. And they're doing really high quality prints from both film and digital photographs. So I'm not saying no one does it. I'm just saying I've never met anyone who does. That's not true. I met someone who at another job had to do it for that job, but no one that I've met in real life for their own use ever bothers, because even when you're doing a high quality, super important, it's going to go to an art gallery in a day kind of printouts, it's just the computer and the printer have that sort of talk pretty well figured out. And there are color profiles from the printer manufacturers that you can use to even maximize that compatibility. Whether I would pay the price for a super fancy color calibration unit that can do printing, that can do printer calibration anyway, is highly, highly questionable. Personally, actually, it's just a flat out no. So that's not a big deal. So the price is very competitive. The fact that it runs on Linux is, you know, even more competitive. And the little software interface that comes with it is fantastic. Again, I didn't expect it to be as good as it is. I really expected it to be a lot less of a product than it is. The software is great. It has a wonderful Linux-y kind of name. It's called DispCalGUI. Of course it would be called DispCalGUI. Why wouldn't they call it DispCalGUI? Name aside, fantastic application. You plug in your color hug. You place it over your monitor so that its little eyeball is pointing at your monitor. So it's almost like a webcam, and it's about the size of a little webcam, too. You just plug it into a mini USB, plug the USB into your computer. It comes with a live CD of Fedora that has just the color calibration tools loaded on it. You can build the thing from source and run it on anything. I've just been using the live CD. And then I save the color profile to a thumb drive. But you put it over your monitor. You start up DispCal GUI and tell it to... Well, I guess you give it a couple of preferences, like what kind of color tables you want to create, and whether you want to calibrate or simply create a profile. So I'm doing calibration and profile because I want it to actually implement everything. And it opens up this fairly large color block of color, and it cycles through different colors. And you just kind of sit back and wait. And that's kind of the workflow of any color correction or any color calibration that I've ever used. That's what you do. And when it's finally finished, you can save the color profile, the ICC file, and I save it to a thumb drive, and then I reboot into the native OS, if there is a native OS other than what I'm using, and I just save the ICC profile in the appropriate folder. Now, for Fedora, you can go, or GNOME, I guess, you can go into System Settings, go into Color Pro, or I think it's just Color is what it's called, and then load in your ICC color profile. It's very, very simple. And the change is visible in many cases, because for me, I don't know about other people, for me, I notice it in the whites a lot. Like, things look unnaturally bright on a non-calibrated monitor to me. And I think that that's kind of the tendency, you know, computer manufacturers tend, I think, to think that brighter is neater, you know, that's more impressive, so that I think they tend to favor that. And very frequently, that's not such a good thing. You don't want that, because the result is that you start thinking that you're shooting everything hot. And you're not. It's just that the whites are blown out on that computer screen. And so you're dialing stuff down, trying to figure out why you've overexposed things, especially in this digital age where overexposure means pixels are lost. It doesn't mean you can just develop it slightly differently and regain the detail in those things. It means those pixels are blank. They're white. They're gone. So it's kind of a scary thing. So calibrating the monitor is not a bad idea. It's a simple process, really. You boot into the little Fedora Live CD. You start DispCal GUI, and you tell it what kind of tables you want. I use the Lux tables with ambient light sensing, I think. And you start the thing going, and it does its own thing. I guess one minor complaint would be that the color hug itself doesn't really stay, it doesn't fall on the monitor, partly because of the USB cable. It's brand new, so it's still kind of, it's got its shape of being coiled. So I kind of had to press the color hug up against the monitor to kind of keep it flat against the monitor. On other devices I've seen, they're heavier. They're made out of metal. They're kind of big and bulky, and you just lay them, you drape it over the monitor, and it kind of stays up against the monitor because they're heavy, and that's how they do it. This didn't do that, so I literally had to hold it, and my arm got tired. But minor complaint, and something that I think a different USB cable will alleviate. Really, really exciting overall. It's a fantastic device. Go to Husky.com. I will include a link for that. I really cannot recommend this highly enough. It is, as far as I know, the only open source colorimeter out there. It's probably, as far as I know, it's, again, the only one truly supporting Linux. It's open source software that it uses to do the calibration. And GNOME is moving in leaps and bounds. I'm not so sure about KDE yet, but I know that GNOME is just making the ICC stuff super simple to implement. I mean, you just go straight to System Settings and tell it what ICC profile you want to use, and you are now calibrated. It's fantastic. Really, seriously, check it out. It's a great, great project. Very, very exciting. Worth every penny if you do any kind of digital media work, visual media work at all. That's about it for this episode, I think. This has been GNU World Order. My name's Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info. You can email me at Klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can IRC me on IRC, Freenode Network, in the channel Bobcast Planet, and a few others. You might also find me on Jabber sometimes. I don't get on there very often lately, but I'm not Klaatu@jabber.org. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time.